as to the Rans of ancient Celtic bards. We are not speaking so much of those delightful love songs with which the writer who conceals his identity under the graceful pseudonym of the Little Sweet Branch has familiarized the book-loving world, but rather, as the contributor D.O.C. points out in an interesting communication published by an Evening Contemporary, of the harsher and more personal note which is found in the satirical effusions of the famous Raftery and of Donald MacConstantine, to say nothing of a more modern lyrist at present very much in the public eye. We subjoin a specimen which has been rendered into English by an eminent scholar, whose name, for the moment, we are not at liberty to disclose, though we believe our readers will find the topical allusion rather more than an indication. The metrical system of the canine original, which recalls the intricate alliterative and isosyllabic rules of the Welsh Englyn, is infinitely more complicated, but we believe our readers will agree that the spirit has been well caught. Perhaps it should be added that the effect is greatly increased if Owen's verse be spoken somewhat slowly and indistinctly, in a tone suggestive of suppressed rancor.
The curse of my curses, 7 days every day, and 7 dry Thursdays on you, Barney Kiernan, has no sup of water to cool my courage and my guts red roaring after Larry's lights.
So we told Terry to bring some water for the dog, and gob, you could hear him lapping it up a mile off, and Joe asked him would he have another. I will, says he, Cara, to show there's no ill feeling. Gob, he's not as green as his cabbage looking, arsing around from one pub to another, leaving it to your own honour, with old Giltrap's dog, and getting fed up by the ratepayers and corporators. Entertainment for man and beast. And says Joe, could you make a hole in another point? Could a swim duck, says I. Same again, Terry, says Joe. Are you sure you won't have anything in the way of liquid refreshments, says he? Thank you, no, says Bloom. As a matter of fact, I just wanted to meet Martin Cunningham, don't you see, about this insurance of poor Dignam's. Martin asked me to go to the house. You see, he, Dignam I mean, didn't serve any notice of the assignment on the company at the time, and nominally, under the Act, the mortgagee can't recover on the policy. Holy war, says Joe, laughing. That's a good one, if old Shylock has landed. So the wife comes out top dog, what? Well, that's a point, says Bloom, for the wife's admirers. Whose admirers, says Joe? The wife's advisers, I mean, says Bloom. Then he starts, all confused, mucking it up about the mortgagor under the Act, like the Lord Chancellor giving it out on the bench, and for the benefit of the wife, and that a trust is created, but on the other hand, that Dignam owed Bridgman the money, and if now the wife or the widow contested the mortgagee's right, till he near had the head of me addled with his mortgagor under the Act. He was bloody safe he wasn't running himself under the Act that time as a rogue and vagabond, only he had a friend in court, selling bazaar tickets, or what do you call it, Royal Hungarian Privilege Lottery. True as you're there. Oh, commend me to an Israelite, Royal and Privileged Hungarian Robbery. So Bob Dorden comes lurching around asking Bloom to tell Mrs. Dignam he was sorry for her trouble, and he was very sorry about the funeral, and to tell her that he said, and everyone who knew him said, that there was never a truer, a finer, than poor little Willie that's dead, to tell her. Choke him with bloody foolery, and shaking Bloom's hand, doing the tragic to tell her that. Shake hands, brother. You're a rogue and I'm another. Let me, says he, so far presume upon our acquaintance, which however slight it may appear, if judged by the standards of mere time, is founded, as I hope and believe, on a sentiment of mutual esteem, as to request of you this favour. But should I have overstepped the limits of reserve, let the sincerity of my feelings be the excuse for my boldness. No, rejoined the other, I appreciate to the full the motives which actuate your conduct, and I shall discharge the office you entrust to me, consoled by the reflection that, though the errand be one of sorrow, this proof of your confidence sweetens in some measure the bitterness of the cup. Then suffer me to take your hand, said he. The goodness of your heart, I feel sure, will dictate to you better than my inadequate words the expressions which are most suitable to convey an emotion whose poignancy, were I to give vent in my feelings, would deprive me even of speech.
And off with them and out, trying to walk straight.
Boozed at 5 o'clock.
Nighty was near being lagged, only Paddy Leonard knew the bobby, 14A.
blind to the world, up in the she being in Broad Street, after closing time, fornicating with two shawls and a bully on guard, drinking porter out of teacups, and calling himself a Frenchie for the shawls, Joseph Manuo, and talking against the Catholic religion. And he's serving Mass in Adam and Eve's when he was young, with his eyes shut, who wrote the New Testament and the Old Testament, and hugging and smugging, and the two shawls, killed with the laughing, picking his pockets, the bloody fool, and he's spilling the porter all over the bed, and the two shawls screeching, laughing at one another, how is your testament? Have you got an Old Testament? Only Paddy was passing there, I tell you what. Then see him of a Sunday with his little concubine of a wife and she wagging her tail up the aisle of the chapel with her patent boots on her no less and her violet's nicest pie down the little lady, Jack Mooney's sister, and the old prostitute of a mother procured in rooms to street couples. Gob, Jack made him toe the line, told him if he didn't patch up the pot, Jesus, he kicked the shite out of him. So Terry brought the 3 points. Here, says Joe, doing the honours. Here, citizen, slán lat, says he. Fortune, Joe, says I. Good health, citizen. Gobby had his mouth halfway down the tumbler already. Want a small fortune to keep him in drinks. Who is the long fella running for the mayoralty, Alf? Says Joe. Friend of yours, says Alf. Nannan, says Joe. The member. I won't mention any names, says Alf. I thought so, says Joe. I saw him up at the meeting now with William Field MP, the cattle traders. Hairy o' yopus, says the citizen. That exploded volcano, the darling of all countries and the idol of his own. So Joe starts telling the citizen about the foot and mouth disease and the cattle traders and taking action in the matter and the citizen sending them all to the right about and Bloom coming out with his sheep dip for the scab and a hoose strength for coughing calves and the guaranteed remedy for timber tongue because he was up one time in a knacker's yard walking about with his book and pencil, here's me head, me heels are coming, till Joe Cuff gave him the order of the boot for giving lip to a grazier. Mr. Know-all, teach your grandmother how to milk ducks. Piss of work was telling me, in the hotel the wife used to be in rivers of tears sometimes with Mrs. O'Dowd, crying her eyes out with her 8 inches of fat all over her, couldn't loosen her farting strings, but old Cod's Eye was waltzing around her, showing her how to do it. What's your programme today? Aye. Humane methods, because the poor animals suffer. And experts say, and best known remedy that doesn't cause pain to the animal, and on the sore spot, administer gently. Gob, he'd have a soft hand under a hen.
Ca-ca-ca-ra, gluck-gluck-gluck. Black Liz is our hen. She lays eggs for us. When she lays her eggs, she is so glad. Ca-ra, gluck-gluck-gluck. Then comes good Uncle Leo. He puts his hand under Black Liz and takes her fresh egg. Ca-ca-ca-ca-ra, gluck-gluck-gluck.
Any house, says Joe. Field and Annette are going over tonight to London to ask about it on the floor of the House of Commons.
Are you sure? Says Bloom. The councillor's going. I wanted to see him as it happens. Well, he's going off by the mailboat, says Joe, tonight.
That's too bad, says Bloom. I wanted particularly, perhaps only Mr. Field is going. I couldn't phone.
No.
You're sure? Nannan's going too, says Joe. The league told him to ask a question tomorrow about the Commissioner of Police forbidding Irish games in the park. What do you think of that, citizen? The slew and a heron.
Mr. Co. Conacre, Multifarnham, Nat.
Arising out of the question of my honourable friend, the member for Shillelagh, may I ask the right honourable gentleman whether the government has issued orders that these animals shall be slaughtered, though no medical evidence is forthcoming as to their pathological condition?
Mr. Allforce, Tam O'Shant, Con.
Honourable members are already in possession of the evidence produced before a committee of the whole House. I feel I cannot usefully add anything to that. The answer to the honourable member's question is in the affirmative.
Mr. Arelli, Montanotti, Nat.
Have similar orders been issued for the slaughter of human animals who dare to play Irish games in the Phoenix Park?
Mr. Allforce, the answer is in the negative.
Mr. Co-Conacre, has the right honourable gentleman's famous Mitchelstown telegram inspired the policy of gentlemen on the Treasury bench?
Oh. Mr. Allforce, I must have notice of that question. Mr. Staliewit, Buncombe, Ind.
Don't hesitate to shoot.
Ironical opposition cheers. The Speaker.
Order! Order!
The House rises. Cheers.
There's the man, says Joe, that made the Gaelic sports revival. There he is, sitting there. The man that got away James Stevens, the champion of all Ireland, at putting a 16-pound shot. What was your best throw, citizen?
No, Bocklesh, says the citizen, letting on to be modest.
There was a time I was as good as the next fella anyhow.
Put it there, citizen, says Joe. You were, and a bloody sight better.
Is that really a fact, says Alf.
Yes, says Bloom. That's well known. Do you not know that? So off they started about Irish sport and Shawneen games, the like of the lawn tennis, and about Hurley and putting the stone and Ressie the soil and building up a nation once again and all that. And of course Bloom had to have his say too about if a fella had a rower's heart, violent exercise was bad. I declare to me Auntie Macassar, if you took up a straw from the bloody floor, and if you said to Bloom, look at Bloom, do you see that straw? That's a straw. Declare to me, Aunt, he'd talk about it for an hour, so he would, and talk steady. A most interesting discussion took place in the ancient hall of Brian Ó Cuanán's in Sroidne Breatnach na Beag, under the auspices of Slua na Héireann, on the revival of ancient Gaelic sports and the importance of physical culture as understood in ancient Greece and ancient Rome and ancient Ireland for the development of the race. The venerable president of this noble order was in the chair, and the attendance was of large dimensions. After an instructive discourse by the chairman, a magnificent oration eloquently and forcibly expressed, a most interesting and instructive discussion of the usual high standard of excellence ensued as to the desirability of the revivability of the ancient games and sports of our ancient pan-Celtic forefathers. The well-known and highly respected worker in the cause of our old tongue, Mr. Joseph McCarthy Hines, made an eloquent appeal for the resuscitation of the ancient Gaelic sports and pastimes, practised morning and evening by Finn McCool, as calculated to revive the best traditions of manly strength and power handed down to us from ancient ages. L. Bloom, who met with a mixed reception of applause and hisses, having espoused the negative, the vocalist chairman brought the discussion to a close in response to repeated requests and hearty plaudits from all parts of a bumper house by a remarkably noteworthy rendering of the immortal Thomas Osborne Davis's evergreen verses, happily too familiar to need recalling here, A Nation Once Again, in the execution of which the veteran patriot champion may be said without fear of contradiction to have fairly excelled himself. The Irish Caruso Garibaldi was in superlative form, and his stentorian notes were heard to the greatest advantage in the time-honoured anthem sung as only our citizen can sing it. His superb high-class vocalism, which by its super quality greatly enhanced his already international reputation, was vociferously applauded by the large audience, among which were to be noticed many prominent members of the clergy, as well as representatives of the press and the bar and other learned professions. The proceedings then terminated. Among the clergy present were the Very Reverend William Delaney, S.J., LL.D., the Right Reverend Gerald Malloy, D.D., the Reverend P.J. Kavanagh, C.S., S.P., the Reverend T. Water, C.C., the Reverend John M. Ivers, P.P., the Reverend P.J. Cleary, O.S.F., the Reverend L.J. Hickey, O.P., the Very Reverend Father Nicholas, O.S.F.C., the Very Reverend B. Gorman, O.D.C., the Reverend T. Maher, S.J., the Very Reverend James Murphy, S.J., the Reverend John Lavery, V.F., the Very Reverend William Doherty, D.D., the Reverend Peter Fagan, O.M., the Reverend T. Brangan, O.S.A., the Reverend J. Flavin, C.C., the Reverend M.A. Hackett, C.C., the Reverend W. Hurley, C.C., the Right Reverend Monsignor McManus, V.G., the Reverend B.R. Slattery, O.M.I., the Very Reverend M.D. Scally, P.P., the Reverend F.T. Purcell, O.P., the Very Reverend Timothy Canon Gorman, P.P., the Reverend J. Flanagan, C.C. The laity included P. Fay, T. Quirk, etc., etc. "Talking about violent exercise," says Alf, "were you at the Kel Bennett match?" "No," says Joe. "I heard so-and-so made a cool £100 over it," says Alf. "Who?" "Blazers," says Joe. And says Bloom, "What I meant about tennis, for example, is the agility and training of the eye." "Aye, blazers," says Alf. "He let out that Milo was on the beer to run the odds, and he's swatting all the time." "We know him," says the citizen, "the traitor's son. We know what put English gold in his pocket. Through fire," says Joe. And Bloom cuts in again about lawn tennis and the circulation of the blood, asking Alf, "Now, don't you think, Bergen?" "Milo does to the floor with him," says Alf. "Heenan and Sayers was only a bloody fool to it. Handed him the father and mother of a beating. See the little kipper not up to his navel, and the big fella swiping. God, he gave him one last puck in the wind. Queensberry rules and all. Made him puke what he never ate." It was a historic and a hefty battle when Milo and Percy were scheduled to don the gloves for the purse of 50 sovereigns. Handicapped as he was by lack of poundage, Dublin's pet lamb made up for it by superlative skill in ringcraft. The final bout of fireworks was a gruelling for both champions. The welterweight sergeant-major had tapped some lively claret in the previous mix-up, during which Keogh had been receiver-general of rights and lefts. the artilleryman putting in some neat work on the pet's nose, and Myla came on looking groggy. The soldier got to business, leading off with a powerful left jab, to which the Irish gladiator retaliated by shooting out a stiff one, flush to the point of Bennett's jaw. The redcoat ducked, but the Dubliner lifted him with a left hook, the body punch being a fine one. The men came to handy grips. Myla quickly became busy and got his man under, the bout ending with the bulkier man on the ropes, Myla punishing him. The Englishman, whose right eye was nearly closed, took his corner, where he was liberally drenched with water, and when the bell went, came on gamey and brimful of pluck, confident of knocking out the fisting of Blanite in jig time. It was a fight to the finish, and the best man for it. The two fought like tigers, and excitement ran fever high. The referee twice cautioned Pucking Percy for holding, but the pet was tricky, and his footwork a treat to watch. After a brisk exchange of courtesies, during which a smart uppercut of the military man brought blood freely from his opponent's mouth, the lamb suddenly waded in all over his man and landed a terrific left to battling Bennett's stomach, flooring him flat. It was a knockout, clean and clever. Amid tense expectation, the Portobello bruiser was being counted out when Bennett's second, Ole Potts-Betstein, threw in the towel, and the Santry boy was declared victor to the frenzied cheers of the public, who broke through the ring ropes and fairly mobbed him with delight.
"He knows which side his bread is buttered," says Alf. "I hear he's running a concert tour now up in the north."
"He is," says Joe, "isn't he?"
"Who?" says Bloom.
"Oh, yes, that's quite true. Yes, a kind of summer tour, you see. Just a holiday."
"Mrs. B is the bright particular star, isn't she?"
says Joe.
"My wife?" says Bloom. "She's singing, yes. I think it'll be a success, too. He's an excellent man to organize. Excellent."
"Oh, big gob," says I to myself, says I. "That explains the milk and the coconut, and absence of hair on the animal's chest. Blaze is doing the tootle on the flute. Concert tour. Dirty down the Dodger's son off Island Bridge that sold the same horses twice over to the government to fight the Boers. Oh, what? I called about the poor and water right, Mr. Boyle, and you what? The water right, Mr. Boyle, and you what? That's the buckle that'll organise her, take my tip, twixt me and you, Catherish."
Pride of Calpe's Rocky Mount, the raven-haired daughter of Tweedy. There grew she to peerless beauty, where loquat and almond scent the air. The gardens of Alameda knew her step, the ghats of olives knew and bowed. The chaste spouse of Leopold is she, Marian of the bountiful bosoms. And lo, there entered one of the clan of the O'Molloys, a comely hero, white face, yet withal somewhat ruddy, his majesty's counsel learned in the law, and with him the prince and heir of the noble line of Lambert.
"Hello, Ned. Hello, Alf. Hello, Jack. Hello, Joe. God save you," says the citizen. "Save you kindly," says J.J. "What'll it be, Ned?"
"Half one," says Ned. So J.J. ordered the drinks.
"Were you round at the court?" says Joe.
"Yes," says J.J. "He'd square that, Ned," says he. "Hope so," says Ned.
"Now, what were those two at?"
J.J. getting them off the grand jury list, and the other giving him a leg over the stile, with his name in Stubbs. "Playing cards, hobnobbing with flash tops, with a swank glass in their eye, drinking fizz, and he half smothered in writs and garnish," he orders. "Pawn and his girl watching Cummins of Francis Street, where no one would know him, in the private office, when I was there with Pisser, releasing his boots out of the pop. What's your name, sir?" "Dunn," says he. "Aye, and Dunn," says I. "Gob, he'll come home by Weeping Cross one of these days, I'm thinking."
"Did you see that bloody lunatic Breen round there?" says Alf. "You pee. Up."
"Yes," says J.J., "looking for a private detective."
"Aye," says Ned, "and he wanted right go wrong to address the court, only Corny Kelleher got round him, telling him to get the handwriting examined first." £10,000, says Alf, laughing. "God, I'd give anything to hear him before a judge and jury."
"Was it you did it, Alf?" says Joe.
"The truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you, Jimmy Johnson." "Me," said Alf, "don't cast your nostrums on my character. Whatever statement you make," says Joe, "would be taken down in evidence against you."
"Of course, an action would lie," says J.J. "It implies that he is not compos mentis, U.P., up."
"Compos your eye," says Alf, laughing. "Do you know that he's balmy? Look at his heads. Do you know that some mornings he has to get his hat on with a shoehorn?"
"Yes," says J.J., "but the truth of a libel is no defence to an indictment for publishing it, in the eyes of the law."
"Ha-ha," Alf, says Joe. "Still," says Bloom, "on account of the poor woman, I mean his wife. Pity about her," says the citizen, "or any other woman marries a half and half."
"How half and half?" says Bloom. "Do you mean he..."
"Half and half, I mean," says the citizen. "A fella that's neither fish nor flesh, nor good red herring," says Joe.
"That's what I mean," says the citizen.
"A pish-og, if you know what that is."
Bigoba saw there was trouble coming, and Bloom explained he meant on account of her being cruel to the wife, having to ground after the old stuttered and fool. Cruelty to animals, so it is, to let that bloody poverty-stricken brain out on grass with his beard out, tripping him, bringing down the rain. And she with her nose cock-a-hoop after she married him because a cousin of his old fellas was pew-opener to the Pope. Picture of him on the wall with the smash-all Sweeney's moustaches, the Signor Brini from Summer Hill, the Italiano, papal zouave to the Holy Father, has left the quay and gone to Moss Street. And here was he, tell us, a nobody, 2 pair back in passages at 7 shillings a week, and he covered with all kinds of breastplates, bidding defiance to the world. And moreover, says JJ, a postcard is publication. It was held to be sufficient evidence of malice in the test case Sadgrove versus Hole. In my opinion, an action might lie. 6 and 8pence, please. Who wants your opinion? Let us drink our pints in peace. God, we won't be let even do that much itself. Well, good health, Jack, says Ned. Good health now, says JJ. There he is again, says Joe. Where? Says Alf. And begob, there he was, passing the door with his books under his oxter, and the wife beside him, and Corny Keller with his wall eye looking in as they went past, talking to him like a father, trying to sell him a second-hand coffin. How did the Canada swindle case go off, says Joe? Remanded, says JJ. One of the bottlenose fraternity it was, went by the name of James Watt, alias Shapiro, alias Spark and Spiro, put an ad in the papers saying he'd give a passage to Canada for 20 bob. What? Do you see any green in the white of my eye? Of course it was a bloody Barney, what? Swindled them all, skivvies and boddocks from the County Meath, aye, and his own kidney too. JJ was telling us there was an ancient Hebrew Zaretsky or something, weeping in the witness box with his hat on him, swearing by the holy Moses he was stuck for 2 quid. Who tried the cases, Joe? Recorder, says Ned. Poor old Sir Frederick, says Alf. You can cod him up to the 2 eyes. Heart as big as a lion, says Ned. Tell him a tale of woe about arrears of rent and a sick wife and a squad of kids, and faith, he'll dissolve in tears on the bench. Aye, says Alf. Reuben J. was bloody lucky he didn't clap him in the dock the other day. For suing poor little Gumley that's minding stones for the corporation there near Butt Bridge. And he starts taking off the old recorder, letting on to cry, a most scandalous thing, this poor, hard-working man. How many children? 10, did you say? Yes, your worship, and my wife has the typhoid. And a wife with typhoid fever, scandalous. Leave the court immediately, sir. No, sir, I'll make no order for payment. How dare you, sir, come up before me and ask me to make an order? A poor, hard-working, industrious man. I dismiss the case.
And whereas on the 16th day of the month of the Ox-Eyed Goddess, and in the 3rd week after the feast day of the Holy and Undivided Trinity, the Daughter of the Skies, the Virgin Moon being then in her first quarter, it came to pass that those learned judges repaired them to the halls of law. There Master Courtney, sitting in his own chamber, gave his rede, and Master Justice Andrews, sitting without a jury in the probate court, weighed well, and pondered the claims of the first chargeant upon the property in the matter of the will propounded and final testamentary disposition in re the real and personal estate of the late lamented Jacob Halliday, vintner, deceased, versus Livingstone, an infant of unsound mind, and another. And to the solemn court of Green Street there came Sir Frederick the Falconer, and he sat him there about the hour of 5 o'clock to administer the law of the Brehons, at the commission for all that and those parts to be beholden in and for the county of the city of Dublin. And there sat with him the high Sindrahim of the 12 tribes of Yar, for every tribe 1 man, of the tribe of Patrick, and of the tribe of Hugh, and of the tribe of Owen, and of the tribe of Con, and of the tribe of Oscar, and of the tribe of Fergus, and of the tribe of Finn, and of the tribe of Dermot, and of the tribe of Cormac, and of the tribe of Kevin, and of the tribe of Quilcher, and of the tribe of Ushin, there being in all 12 good men and true. And he conjured them by him who died on Rood, that they should well and truly try and true deliverance make in the issue joined between their sovereign lord, the king, and the prisoner at the bar, and true verdict give, according to the evidence, so help them God, and kiss the books. And they rose in their seats, those 12 of Yah, and they swore, by the name of him who is from everlasting, that they would do his right wiseness. And straightway the minions of the law led forth from their donjon keep one whom the sleuth-hounds of justice had apprehended in consequence of information received. And they shackled him hand and foot, and would take of him nay bail, nay main prize, but preferred a charge against him,
for he was a malefactor. "These are nice things," says the citizen, "coming over here to Ireland, filling the country with bugs." So Bloom lets on he heard nothing, and he starts talking with Joe, telling him he needn't trouble about that little matter till the first, but if he would just say a word to Mr. Crawford. And so Joe swore high and holy by this and by that, he'd do the devil and all. "Because, you see," says Bloom, "for an advertisement, you must have repetition. That's the whole secret."
"Rely on me," says Joe. "Swindling the peasants," says the citizen, "and the poor of Ireland. We want no more strangers in our house."
"Oh, I'm sure that'll be all right, Hines," says Bloom. "It's just the keys, you see."
"Consider that done," says Joe.
"Very kind of you," says Bloom.
"The strangers," says the citizen. "Our own fault. We let them come in. We brought them. The adulteress and our paramour brought the Saxon robbers here."
"Decree nisi," says J.J.
And Bloom, letting on to be awfully deeply interested in nothing, espied us webbing the corner behind the barrel, and the citizen scowling after him, and the old dog at his feet looking up to know who to bite and when. "A dishonoured wife," says the citizen. "That's what's the cause of all our misfortunes." "And here she is," says Alf, that was giggling over the police gazette with Terry on the counter, "in all our war paint. Give us a squint at her," says I. "And what was it? Only one of the smutty Yankee pictures Terry borrows off of Corny Kelleher. Secrets for enlarging your private parts. Misconduct of society, Bell. Norman W. Tupper, wealthy Chicago contractor, finds pretty but faithless wife in lap of Officer Taylor. Bell in her bloomers, misconducting herself and her fancy man feeling for her tickles. And Norman W. Tupper bouncing in with his pea shooter just in time to be late after she'd done the trick of the loop with Officer Taylor."
"Oh, Jacobs, Jenny," says Joe. "How short your shirt is."
"There's hair, Joe," says I. "Get a queer old tail end of corned beef off of that one, what?" So anyhow, in came John Wise Nolan and Lenehan with them, with a face on them as long as a late breakfast. "Well," says the citizen, "what's the latest from the scene of action? What did those tinkers in the City Hall at their caucus meeting decide about the Irish language?"
O'Nolan, clad in shining armour, low-bending, made obeisance to the puissant and high and mighty chief of all Erin, and did him to wit of that which had befallen. How that the grave elders of the most obedient city, second of the realm, had met them in the Thalsal, and there, after due prayers to the gods who dwell in ether supernal, had taken solemn counsel, whereby they might, if so be it might be, bring once more into honour among mortal men the winged speech of the sea-divided Grail.
"It's on the march," says the citizen, "to hell with the bloody brutal Sassenachs and their patois." So J.J. puts in a word, doing the toff, about one story was goodly, I heard another, and blinking facts, and the Nelson policy, putting your blind eye to the telescope, and drawing up a bill of attainder to impeach a nation, and Bloom trying to back him up moderation and botheration, and their colonies and their civilization. "The civilization, you mean," says the citizen. "To hell with them. The curse of a good-for-nothing god lights sideways on the bloody thick-lug sons a horse gets. No music, and no art, and no literature worthy of the name. Any civilization they have, they stole from us, tongue-tied sons of bastards, ghosts."
"The European family," says J.J.
"They're not European," says the citizen. "I was in Europe at Cavenagan of Paris. You wouldn't see a trace of them or their language anywhere in Europe except in a Cabernet des Sons."
And says John Wise, "Full many a flower is born to blush unseen." And says Lenehan, that knows a bit of the lingo,
"Conspire les Anglais. Perfide Albion,"
he said, and then lifted he in his rude, great, brawny, strengthy hands the mether of dark, strong, foamy ale, and uttering his tribal slogan, "Love Daragaboo," he drank to the undoing of his foes, a race of mighty, valorous heroes, rulers of the waves, who sit on thrones of alabaster, silent as the deathless gods.
"What's up with you?" says I to Lenehan. "You look like a fella that lost a bob and found a tanner."
"Gold cup," says he.
"Who won, Mr. Lenehan?" says Terry.
"Throw away," says he, "a 20-1, a rank outsider, and the rest nowhere."
"And Bass's mare?" says Terry. "Still running," says he. "We're all in a cart. Boylan plunged 2 quid on my tip sceptre for himself and a lady friend."
"I'd half a crown myself," says Terry, "on Zinfandel that Mr. Flynn gave me, Lord Howard of Walden's."
20-1, says Lenehan. "Such is life in an outhouse." "Throw away," says he. "Takes the biscuit, and talking about bunions. Frailty, thy name is Sefter." So he went over to the biscuit tin Bob Doran left to see if there was anything he could lift on the nod. The old cur after him, backing his luck with his mangy snout up, old Mother Hubbard went to the cupboard.
"Not there, my child," says he. "Keep your pecker up," says Joe. "She'd have won the money only for the other dog."
and JJ and the citizen arguing about law and history, with Bloom sticking in an odd word. Some people, says Bloom, can see the mote in others' eyes, but they can't see the beam in their own. Ramesh, says the citizen. There's no one as blind as the fella that won't see, if you know what that means. Where are our missing 20 million of Irish should be here today instead of 4? Our lost tribes, and our potteries and textiles, the finest in the whole world. And our wool that was sold in Rome in the time of Juvenal, and our flax and our damask from the looms of Antrim, and our Limerick lace, our tanneries, and our white flint lass down there by Ballybock, and our Huguenot poplin that we have since Jacquard de Leon, and our woven silk and our Foxford tweeds, and ivory raised point from the Carmelite convents in New Ross, nothing like it in the whole wide world. Where are the Greek merchants that came through the Pillars of Hercules, the Gibraltar, now grabbed by the foe of mankind, with gold and Tyrian purple to sell in Wexford at the Fair of Carmen? Read Tacitus and Tomley, even Giraldus Cambrensis. Wine, peltries, Connemara marble, silver from Tipperary, second to none. Our far-famed horses even today, the Irish hobbies, with King Philip of Spain offering to pay customs duties for the right to fish in our waters. What do the Yellow Johns of Anglia owe us for our ruined trade and our ruined hearts? And the beds of the Barrow and Shannon they won't deepen with millions of acres of marsh and bog to make us all die of consumption. As treeless as Portugal will be soon, says John Moyes, or Heligoland, with its one tree, if something is not done to reforest the land. Larches, firs, all the trees of the Conifer family are gone fast. I was reading a report of Lord Castletown's. Save them, says the citizen. The giant ash of Galway and the chieftain elm of Kildare with a 40-foot bole and an acre of foliage. Save the trees of Ireland for the future men of Ireland on the fair hills of Erden O. Europe has its eyes on you, says Lenehan. The fashionable international world attended en masse this afternoon at the wedding of the Chevalier Jean Wise de Newlin, Grand High Chief Ranger of the Irish National Foresters, with Miss Fir Conifer of Pine Valley. Lady Sylvester Elmshade, Mrs. Barbara Lovebirch, Mrs. Paul Ash, Mrs. Holly Hazel-Eyes, Miss Daphne Bays, Miss Dorothy Canebrake, Mrs. Clyde Twelvetrees, Mrs. Rowan Green, Mrs. Helen Vinegadding, Miss Virginia Creeper, Miss Gladys Beach, Miss Olive Garth, Miss Blanche Maple, Mrs. Maud Mahogany, Miss Myra Myrtle, Miss Priscilla Elderflower, Miss B. Honeysuckle, Miss Grace Poplar, Miss Omamosa San, Miss Rachel Cedarfrond, the Mrs. Lillian and Viola Lilac, Miss Timidity Aspinall, Mrs. Kitty Dewey Moss, Miss May Hawthorne, Mrs. Gloriana Palm, Mrs. Leanna Forrest, Mrs. Arabella Blackwood and Mrs. Norma Holyoake of Oakcombe Regis graced the ceremony by their presence. The bride, who was given away by her father, the McConifer of the Glens, looked exquisitely charming in a creation carried out in green mercerized silk, moulded on an underslip of gloaming grey, sashed with a yoke of broad emerald, and finished with a triple flounce of darker hued fringe, the scheme being relieved by bretelle and hip insertions of acorn bronze. The maids of honour, Miss Larch Conifer and Miss Spruce Conifer, sisters of the bride, wore very becoming costumes in the same tone, a dainty motif of plume rose being worked into the pleats in a pinstripe and repeated capriciously in the jade-green toques in the form of heron feathers of pale-tinted coral. Senor Enrique Flor presided at the organ with his well-known ability, and, in addition to the prescribed numbers of the nuptial mass, played a new and striking arrangement of Woodman Spare That Tree at the conclusion of the service. On leaving the church of St. Fiacre in Horto, after the papal blessing, the happy pair were subjected to a playful crossfire of hazelnuts, beechmast, bay leaves, catkins of willow, ivy tod, hollyberries, mistletoe sprigs, and quicken shoots. Mr. and Mrs. Wise Conifer Newlin will spend a quiet honeymoon in the Black Forest. "And our eyes are on Europe," says the citizen. "We had a trade with Spain and the French and with the Flemings before those mongrels were pupped. Spanish ale in Galway, the wine bark on the wine dark waterway, and will again," says Joe. "And with the help of the Holy Mother of God, we will again," says the citizen, clapping his thigh. "Our harbours that are empty will be full again. Queenstown, Kinsale, Galway, Blacksod Bay, Ventry in the Kingdom of Kerry, Killybegs, the third largest harbour in the wide world, with a fleet of masts of the Galway Lynches and the Kavanagh Roylies and the O'Kennedys of Dublin when the Earl of Desmond could make a treaty with the Emperor Charles V himself. And will again," says he.
when the first Irish battleship is seen breasting the waves with our own flag to the fore, none of your Henry Tudor harps. No, the oldest flag afloat, the flag of the province of Desmond and Thomond, three crowns on a blue field, the three sons of Meletius. And he took the last swig out of the point, Moya. All wind and pissed like a tanyard cat. Cows and Connacht have long horns. As much as his bloody life is worth, to go down and address his tall talk to the assembled multitude in Shanagolden, where he daredn't show his nose with the Molly Maguires looking for him to let daylight through him for grabbing the holding of an evicted tenant. "Hear, hear to that," says John Wise. "What will you have?" "An imperial yeomanry," says Lenehan, "to celebrate the occasion." "Half one, Terry," says John Wise, "and a hands up." "Terry, are you asleep?" "Yes, sir," says Terry. "Small whiskey and bottle of Allsop." "Right, sir." Hanging over the bloody paper with Alf, looking for spicy bits, instead of attending to the general public. Picture of a button match, trying to crack their bloody skulls, one chap going for the other with his head down like a bull at a gate, and another one, Black Beast burned in Omaha, Georgia. A lot of Deadwood dicks in slouch hats, and they firing at a Sambo strung up on a tree, with his tongue out and a bonfire under him. Gob, they ought to drown him in the sea after and electrocute and crucify him to make sure of their job. "But what about the fighting navy," says Ned, "that keeps our foes at bay?" "I'll tell you what about it," says the citizen. "Hell upon earth it is. Read the revelation that's going on in the papers about flogging on the training ships at Portsmouth. A fellow writes that calls himself Disgusted One." So he starts telling us about corporal punishment and about the crew of tars and officers and rear admirals drawn up in cocked hats and the parson with his Protestant Bible to witness punishment and a young lad brought out howling for his ma and they tie him down on the butt end of a gun. "A rump and dozen," says the citizen, was what that old ruffian Sir John Beresford called it. But the modern God's Englishman calls it caning on the breach. And says John Wise, "'tis a custom more honoured in the breach than in the observance." Then he was telling us the master at arms comes along with a long cane and he draws out and he flogs the bloody backside off the poor lad till he yells, "Melia murder." "That's your glorious British Navy," says the citizen, "that bosses the earth. The fellows that never will be slaves with the only heredity chamber on the face of God's earth and their land in the hands of a dozen game hogs and cotton ball barons. That's the great empire they boast about of drudges and whipped serfs on which the sun never rises," says Joe. "And the tragedy of it is," says the citizen, "they believe it. The unfortunate yahoos believe it." "They believe in Rod, the Scourger Almighty, creator of hell upon earth, and in Jackie Tar, the son of a gun, who was conceived of unholy boast, born of the fighting navy, suffered under rumpin' dozen, was scarified, flayed and carried, yelled like bloody hell, the third day he rose again from the bed, steered into haven. Sitteth on his beam end till further orders, whence he shall come to drudge for a living and be paid." "But," says Bloom, "isn't discipline the same everywhere? I mean, wouldn't it be the same here if you put force against force? Didn't I tell you? As true as I'm drinking this porter, if he was at his last gasp, he'd try to downface you that dying was living." "We'll put force against force," says the citizen. "We have our greater Ireland beyond the sea. They were driven out of house and home with the Black 47, their mud cabins and their sheilings by the roadside were laid low by the battering ram, and the Times rubbed its hands and told the white-livered Saxons there would soon be as few Irish in Ireland as redskins in America. Even the Grand Turk sent us his piastres, but the Sassenach tried to starve the nation at home while the land was full of crops that the British hyenas bought and sold in Rio de Janeiro. Aye, they drove out the peasants in hordes. 20,000 of them died in the coffin ships, but those that came to the land of the free remember the land of bondage, and they will come again, and with a vengeance, no cravens, the sons of Grania Whale, the champions of Catlinia Houlihan." "Perfectly true," says Bloom. "But my point was, we're a long time waiting for that day, citizen," says Ned, "since the poor old woman told us that the French were on the sea and landed at Killala." "Aye," says John Moyse, "we fought for the Royal Stuarts that reneged us against the Williamites and they betrayed us. Remember Limerick and the broken treaty stone? We gave our best blood to France and Spain, the wild geese. Fontenoy, eh? And Sarsfield and O'Donnell, Duke of Tretuan in Spain, and Ulysses Brown of Camus that was field marshal to Maria Theresa. But what did we ever get for it?" "The French," says the citizen. "Set of dancing masters. Do you know what it is? They were never worth a roasted fart to Ireland, and they're trying to make an entente cordiale now at Taipei's dinner party with perfidious Albion, four brands of Europe, and they always were." "Conspire les Français," says Lenehan, nubbling his beer.
And as for the Prussians and the Hanoverians, says Joe, haven't we had enough of those sausage-eating bastards on the throne, from George the Elector down to the German lad and the flatulent old bitch that's dead?
Jesus, I had to laugh the way he came out with that, about the old one with the winkers on her, blind drunk in her royal palace every night of God, old Vic with a jorum of Mountain Dew and a coachman carting her up body and bones to roll into bed, and she pulling him by the whiskers and singing them old bits of songs about Erin on the Rhine and come where the booze is cheaper. Well, says J.J., we have Edward the Peacemaker now. Tell that you a fool, says the citizen. There's a bloody sight more pox than pax about that bio, Edward Guelph Wetton. And what do you think, says Joe, of the holy boys, the priests and bishops of Ireland, doing up his room in Maynooth in his satanic majesty racing colours, and sticking up pictures of all the horses his jockeys rode, the Earl of Dublin no less? They ought to have stuck up all the women he rode himself, says little Alf. And says J.J., considerations of space influence their lordship's decision. Will you try another, citizen? Says Joe. Yes, sir, says he, I will. You, says Joe. Behold unto you, Joe, says I. May your shadow never grow less. Repeat that dose, says Joe. Bloom was talking and talking to John Moyes, and he quite excited, with his dun duckety mud-coloured mug on him and his old plum eyes rolling about. Persecution, says he, all the history of the world is full of it, perpetuating national hatred among nations. But do you know what a nation means? Says John Moyes. Yes, says Bloom. What is it? Says John Moyes. A nation, says Bloom, a nation is the same people living in the same place. Be God then, says Ned, laughing, if that's so, I'm a nation, for I'm living in the same place for the past 5 years. So, of course, everyone had a laugh at Bloom, and says he, trying to muck out a bit, or also living in different places. That covers my case, says Joe. What is your nation, if I may ask? Says the citizen. Ireland, says Bloom. I was born here, Ireland. The citizen said nothing, only cleared the spit out of his gullet, and gob, he spat a red bank oyster out of him, right in the corner. After you with the push, Joe, says he, taking out his handkerchief to swab himself dry. Here you are, citizen, says Joe. Take that in your right hand and repeat after me the following words. The much-treasured and intricately embroidered ancient Irish facecloth, attributed to Solomon of Droma and Manus Tomalacht Og MacDonagh, authors of the Book of Ballymote, was then carefully produced and called forth prolonged admiration. No need to dwell on the legendary beauty of the corner pieces, the acme of art, wherein one can distinctly discern each of the four evangelists in turn, presenting to each of the four masters his evangelical symbol, a bog oak sceptre, a North American puma, a far nobler king of beasts than the British article, be it said in passing, a Kerry calf, and a golden eagle from Carron Tuil. The scenes depicted on the Amongtree field, showing our ancient dunes and raths and cromlechs and greenons and seats of learning and maledictive stones, are as wonderfully beautiful, and the pigments as delicate, as when the Sligo illuminators gave free rein to their artistic fantasy long, long ago in the time of the Barmecides. Glendalough, the lovely lakes of Killarney, the ruins of Clonmacnoise, Cong Abbey, Glenannor and the Twelve Pins, Ireland's Eye, the Green Hills of Talla, Croagh-Patrick, the brewery of Messrs. Arthur Guinness, Son and Company Limited, Loch Ness Banks, the Vale of Avoca, Isolde's Tower, the Mappus Obelisk, Sir Patrick Down's Hospital, Cape Clear, the Glen of Aherlow, Lynch's Castle, the Scotch House, Rathdown Union Workhouse at Loughlinstown, Tullamore Jail, Castle Connell Rapids, Kilbally MacShonachill, the Cross at Monaster Boyce, Jury's Hotel, St. Patrick's Purgatory, the Salmon Leap, Maynooth College Refectory, Curley's Hole, the three birthplaces of the first Duke of Wellington, the Rock of Cashel, the Bog of Allen, the Henry Street Warehouse, Fingal's Cave, all these moving scenes are still there for us today, rendered more beautiful still by the waters of sorrow which have passed over them and by the rich incrustations of time. Shove us over the drinks, says I. Which is which? That's mine, says Joe, as the devil said to the dead policeman. And I belong to a race too, says Bloom, that is hated and persecuted, also now, this very moment, this very instant. Gob, he near burnt his fingers with the butt of his old cigar. Robbed, says he, plundered, insulted, persecuted, taking what belongs to us by right, at this very moment, says he, putting up his fist. Sold by auction, off in Morocco, like slaves or cattle. You're talking about the New Jerusalem, says the citizen. I'm talking about injustice, says Bloom. Right, says John Moyes. Stand up to it, then, with force, like men. That's an almanac picture for you. Mark for a soft-nosed bullet. Old lardy face standing up to the business end of a gun. Gob, he'd adorn a sweeping brush, so he would, if only he had a nurse's apron on him.
and then he collapses all of a sudden, twisting around all the opposite, as limp as a wet rag. But it's no use, is he? Force, hatred, history, all that. That's not life for men and women, insult and hatred. And everybody knows that it's the very opposite of that that is really life.
What? Says Alf.
Love, says Bloom. I mean the opposite of hatred. I must go now, says he to John Wise. Just around to the court a moment to see if Martin is there. If he comes, just say I'll be back in a second. Just a moment.
Who's him, didn't you?
And off he pops like grease lightning.
A new apostle to the Gentiles, says the citizen. Universal love.
Well, says John Wise, isn't that what we're told? Love your neighbours.
That chap, says the citizen. Beggar my neighbour is his motto. Love my, yeah. He's a nice pattern of a Romeo and Juliet.
Love loves to love love. Nurse loves the new chemist. Constable 14A loves Mary Kelly. Gertie McDowell loves the boy that has the bicycle. M.B. loves a fair gentleman. Lee Chi Han, lovey up kissy, chap poo chow. Jumbo the elephant loves Alice the elephant. Old Mr. Vershoyle, with the ear trumpet, loves old Mrs. Vershoyle with the turned-in eye. The man in the brown Macintosh loves a lady who is dead. His Majesty the King loves Her Majesty the Queen. Mrs. Norman W. Topper loves Officer Taylor. You love a certain person, and this person loves that other person, because everybody loves somebody, but God loves everybody.
Well, Joe, says I, you're very good health and song. More power, citizen. Hurrah there, says Joe. The blessing of God and Mary and Patrick on you, says the citizen. And he ups with his point to wet his whistle. We know those canters, says he, preaching and picking your pockets. What about sanctimonious Cromwell and his Ironsides that put the women and children of Drogheda to the sword with the Bible text, God is love, pasted round the mouth of his cannon? The Bible? Did you read that skit in the United Irishman today about that Zulu chief that's visiting England? What's that? Says Joe. So the citizen takes up one of his paraphernalia papers and he starts reading out. A delegation of the chief cotton magnates of Manchester was presented yesterday to His Majesty the Alakoi of Abiakuta by Goldstick-in-Waiting, Lord Walkup on Eggs, to tender to His Majesty the heartfelt thanks of British traders for the facilities afforded them in his dominions. The delegation partook of luncheon, at the conclusion of which the dusky potentate, in the course of a happy speech, freely translated by the British chaplain, the Reverend Ananias Praise God Barebones, tendered his best thanks to Massa Walkup and emphasised the cordial relations existing between Abiakuta and the British Empire, stating that he treasured as one of his dearest possessions an illuminated Bible, the volume of the Word of God, and the secret of England's greatness, graciously presented to him by the White Chief Woman, the Great Squaw Victoria, with a personal dedication from the august hand of the royal donor. The Alakoi then drank a loving cup of four-shot ishkaba to the toast, black and white, from the skull of his immediate predecessor in the dynasty Kakachakachak, surnamed 40 Watts, after which he visited the chief factory of Cottonopolis and signed his mark in the visitor's book, subsequently executing an old Abiakutic war dance, in the course of which he swallowed several knives and forks amid hilarious applause from the girl hands. Widow woman, says Ned, I wouldn't doubt her. Wonder did he put that Bible to the same use as I would.
Same only more so, says Lenehan, and thereafter in that fruitful land the broad-leaved mango flourished exceedingly.
Is that by Griffith? Says John Wise.
No, says the citizen. It's not signed Shangana. It's only initial P, and a very good initial too, says Joe.
That's how it works, says the citizen. Trade follows the flag.
Well, says JJ, if they're any worse than those Belgians in the Congo Free State, they must be bad.
Did you read that report by a man? What's his name is?
Casement, says the citizen. He's an Irishman.
Yes, that's the man, says JJ, raping the women and girls and flogging the natives on the belly to squeeze all the red rubber they can out of them.
I know where he's gone, says Lenin, cracking his fingers.
Who? Says I.
Bloom, says he. The courthouse is a blind. He had a few bob on throwaway, and he's gone to gather in the shekels.
Is it that white-eyed Kaffir, says the citizen, that never backed a horse and angler in his life?
That's where he's gone, says Lenin.
I met Bantam Lyons going to back that horse, only I put him off it, and he told me Bloom gave him the tip. Betcha what you like, he has 100 shillings to five on. He's the only man in Dublin has it.
A dark horse. He's a bloody dark horse himself, says Joe. Mind, Joe, says I, show us the entrance out.
There you are, says Terry.
Good boy, Ireland, I'm going to Gort.
So I just went round to the back of the yard to pump ship and be gob.
100 shillings to 5.
While I was letting off me...
Throwaway, 22.
Letting off me load, gob, says I to myself, I knew he was uneasy in his...
2 points off of Joe, and 1 in Slattery's off.
In his mind, to get off the mark to...
100 shillings is 5 quid. And when they were in the
dark horse,
piss of work was telling me card party and letting on the child was sick.
Gob, must have done about a gallon.
Flabby arse of a wife speaking down the tube. She's better or she's...
Ow.
All a plan so we could vamoose with the pool if he won or...
Jesus, full up I was.
Trading without a license.
Ow.
Oil in my nation, says he. Never be up to those bloody...
There's the last of it.
Jerusalem.
Ah.
Cuckoos. So anyhow, when I got back, they were at it ding-dong. John Moyes saying it was Bloom gave the idea for Sinn Féin to Griffith to put in his paper all kinds of gerrymandering, pack juries and swindle the taxes off of the government and appointing councils all over the world to walk about selling Irish industries, robbing Peter to pay Paul. Gob, that puts the bloody kibosh on it if old sloppy eyes is mucking up the show. Give us a bloody chance. God save Ireland from the likes of that bloody mouseabout. Mr. Bloom with his argol bargol and his elfella before him, perpetuating frauds. All Methuselah and Bloom, the robbing bagman, that poisoned himself with the prussic acid after he swamping the country with his baubles and his penny diamonds. Loans by post on easy terms. Any amount of money advanced on note of hand. Distance no object, no security. Gobbies like Lanty McHale's goat that'd go a piece of the road with everyone. Well, it's a fact, says John Moyes. And there's the man now that'll tell you about it, Martin Cunningham. Sure enough, the castle car drove up with Martin on it, and Jack Parr with him, and a fella named Crofter or Crofton, pensioner out of the Collector General's, an Ordnance man Blackburn does have on the registration, and he'd drawn his pay, or Crawford, gallivanting around the country at the King's expense. Our travellers reached the rustic hostelry and alighted from their palfreys. "Ho, varlet," cried he, who by his mien seemed the leader of the party. "Saucy knave, to us!" So saying, he knocked loudly with his sword hilt upon the open lattice. Mine host came forth at the summons, girding him with his tabard. "Give you good den, my masters," said he, with an obsequious bow. "Bestir thyself, sirrah," cried he who had knocked. "Look to our steeds, and for ourselves give us of your best, for if faith we need it." "Lack-a-day, good masters," said the host. "My poor house has but a bare larder. I know not what to offer your lordships." "How now, fellow?" cried the second of the party, a man of pleasant countenance. "So servest thou the king's messengers, Master Tapton?" An instantaneous change overspread the landlord's visage. "Cry you mercy, gentlemen," he said humbly. "And you be the king's messengers, God shield his majesty. You shall not want for aught. The king's friends, God bless his majesty, shall not go a-fasting in my house, I warrant me." "Then about," cried the traveller who had not spoken, a lusty trencherman by his aspect, "has aught to give us?" Mine host bowed again as he made answer. "What say you, good masters, to a squab pigeon pasty, some collops of venison, a saddle of veal, widgeon with crisp hog's bacon, a boar's head with pistachios, a basin of jolly custard, a medlar tansy, and a flagon of old Rhenish?" "Gadzooks," cried the last speaker, "that likes me well. Pistachios." "Aha," cried he of the pleasant countenance, "a poor house and a bare larder," quoth I. "'Tis a merry rogue." So in comes Martin, asking where was Bloom. "Where is he?" says Lenehan, "defrauding widows and orphans." "Isn't that a fact," says John Moyes, "what I was telling the citizen about Bloom of the Sinn Féin?" "That's so," said Martin, "or so they allege." "Who made those allegations?" says Alf. "I," says Joe, "I'm the alligator." "And after all," says John Moyes, "why can't a Jew love his country like the next fella? Why not," says J.J., "when he's quite sure which country it is? Is he a Jew or a Gentile or a Holy Roman or a swaddler or what the hell is he?" says Ned. "Or who is he?" "No offence, Crofton." "We don't want him," says Crofton the Ordnanceman or Presbyterian. "Who is Junius?" says J.J. "He's a perverted Jew," says Martin, "from a place in Hungary, and it was he drew up all the plans according to the Hungarian system. We know that in the castle." "Isn't he a cousin of Bloom, the dentist?" says Jack Power. "Not at all," says Martin. "Only namesakes. His name was Virag, the father's name that poisoned himself. He changed it by deed poll, the father did." "That's the new Messiah for Ireland," says the citizen. "Ireland of saints and sages." "Well, they're still waiting for their Redeemer," says Martin. "For that matter, so are we." "Yes," says J.J., "and every male that's born, they think it may be their Messiah, and every Jew is in a tall state of excitement, I believe, till he knows if he's a father or a mother." "Expecting every moment will be his next," says Lenehan. "Oh, by God," says Ned, "you should have seen Bloom before that son of his that died was born. I met him one day in the South City markets, buying a tin of Neve's food, 6 weeks before the wife was delivered." "En ventre sa mère," says J.J. "Do you call that a man?" says the citizen. "I wonder did he ever put it out of sight," says Joe. Well, there were two children born anyhow, says Jack Power. And who does he suspect? Says the citizen. God, there's many a true word spoken in jest. One of those mixed middlings he is. Lying up in the hotel, Pisser was telling me, once a month with headache, like a totty with her courses. Do you know what I'm telling you? It'd be an act of God to take a hold of a fella the like of that and throw him in the bloody sea. Justifiable homicide, so it would. Then sloping off with his £5 without putting up a pint of stuff like a man. Give us your blessing. Not as much as would blind your eye. Charity to the neighbour, says Martin. But where is he? We can't wait. A wolf in sheep's clothing, says the citizen. That's what he is. Virag from Hungary. Ahasuerus, I call him. Cursed by God. Have you time for a brief libation, Martin? Says Ned. Only one, says Martin. We must be quick. JJ and S. You, Jack. Crofton. 3 half-1s, Terry. St. Patrick would want to land again in Ballykinlar and convert us, says the citizen, after allowing things like that to contaminate our shores. Well, says Martin, rapping for his glass, God bless all here is my prayer. Amen, says the citizen. And I'm sure he will, says Joe. And at the sound of the saccharine bell, headed by a crucifer with acolytes, thurifers, boat-bearers, readers, ostiari, deacons and subdeacons, the blessed company drew nigh of mitred abbots and priors and guardians and monks and friars, the monks of Benedict of Spoleto, Carthusians and Camaldolese, Cistercians and Olivetans, Oratorians and Valambrosans, and the friars of Augustine, Brigidines, Premonstratesians, Servi, Trinitarians, and the children of Peter Nolasco, and therewith from Carmel Mount the children of Elijah, prophet, led by Albert Bishop, and by Teresa of Avila, Calst, and other, and friars brown and grey, sons of poor Francis, Capuchins, Cordeliers, Minimes, and Observants, and the daughters of Clara, and the sons of Dominic, the friars' preachers, and the sons of Vincent, and the monks of St. Wolston, and Ignatius' children, and the confraternity of the Christian brothers, led by the Reverend Brother Edmund Ignatius Rice. And after came all saints and martyrs, virgins and confessors, St. Sir and St. Isidore Arator, and St. James the Less, and St. Phocas of Sinope, and St. Julian Hospitator, and St. Felix de Cantalice, and St. Simon Stylites, and St. Stephen Protomartyr, and St. John of God, and St. Ferial, and St. Luguard, and St. Theodotus, and St. Vulmar, and St. Richard, and St. Vincent de Paul, and St. Martin of Todi, and St. Martin of Tours, and St. Alfred, and St. Joseph, and St. Denis, and St. Cornelius, and St. Leopold, and St. Bernard, and St. Terence, and St. Edward, and St. Owen Caniculus, and St. Anonymous, and St. Eponymous, and St. Pseudonymous, and St. Hermonymous, and St. Peronymous, and St. Synonymous, and St. Lawrence O'Toole, and St. James of Dingle, and Compostella, and St. Colum Kill, and St. Columba, and St. Celestine, and St. Coleman, and St. Kevin, and St. Brendan, and St. Frigidian, and St. Senan, and St. Faulkner, and St. Columbanus, and St. Gaul, and St. Fursey, and St. Fintan, and St. Fiacre, and St. John Nepomuc, and St. Thomas Aquinas, and St. Ives of Brittany, and St. Michin, and St. Herman Joseph, and the three patrons of holy youth, St. Aloysius Gonzaga, St. Stanislaus Kostka, and St. John Bershmans. And the Saints Gervasius, Servatius, and Bonifacius, and St. Bride, and St. Kernan, and St. Canis of Kilkenny, and St. Jarlath of Tuam, and St. Vinbar, and St. Papin of Ballymun, and Brother Aloysius Pacificus, and Brother Louis Bellicosus, and the Saints Rose of Lima, and of Viterbo, and St. Martha of Bethany, and St. Mary of Egypt, and St. Lucy, and St. Bridget, and St. Attractor, and St. Dymphna, and St. Eta, and St. Marian Calpensis, and the Blessed Sister Teresa of the Child Jesus, and St. Barbara, and St. Scholastica, and St. Ursula, with 11,000 virgins. And all came with nimbi and aureoles and gloriae, bearing palms and harps and swords and olive crowns in robes, whereon were woven the blessed symbols of the efficacies, inkhorns, arrows, loaves, cruses, fetters, axes, trees, bridges, babes in a bathtub, shells, wallets, shears, keys, dragons, lilies, buckshot, beards, hogs, lamps, bellows, beehives, soup ladles, stars, snakes, anvils, boxes of Vaseline, bells, crutches, forceps, stag's horns, watertight boots, hawks, millstones, eyes on a dish, wax candles, aspergills, unicorns. And as they wended their way by Nelson's Pillar, Henry Street, Mary Street, Capel Street, Little Britain Street, chanting the introit in Epiphania Domini, which beginneth, Surge Illuminare, and thereafter most sweetly the gradual Omnes, which saith, De Saba Venient, they did divers wonders, such as casting out devils, raising the dead to life, multiplying fishes, healing the halt and the blind, discovering various articles which had been mislaid, interpreting and fulfilling the scriptures, blessing and prophesying. And last, beneath a canopy of cloth of gold, came the Reverend Father O'Flynn, attended by Malachy and Patrick. And when the good fathers had reached the appointed place, the house of Bernard Kiernan and Co., Limited, 8, 9 and 10 Little Britain Street, wholesale grocers, wine and brandy shippers, licensed for the sale of beer, wine and spirits for consumption on the premises, the celebrant blessed the house and censed the mullion windows, and the groins and the vaults and the arrases and the capitals and the pediments and the cornices and the engrailed arches and the spires and the cupolas, and sprinkled the lintels thereof with blessed water, and prayed that God might bless that house, as he had blessed the house of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and make the angels of his light to inhabit therein. And entering, he blessed the viands and the beverages, and the company of all the blessed answered his prayers. Adjutorium nostrum in nomine Domini, qui fecit caelum et terram, Dominus vobiscum, ecum spiritu tuo. And he laid his hands upon the blessed and gave thanks, and he prayed, and they all with him prayed. Deus cuius verbo sanctificantur omnia, benedictionem tuum effunde super creaturas istas, et praesta ut quisquis ei secundum legum et voluntatem tuam congratiarum actione usus fuerit per invocationem sanctissimi nominis tui corporis sanitatem et anime tutelam te octore precipiat per Christum Dominum nostrum.
And so say all of us, says Jack. Thousand a year, Lambert, says Crofton or Crawford. Right, says Ned, taking up his John Jemison, and butter for fish.
I was just looking round to see who the happy thought would strike, when be damned, but in he comes again, letting on to be in a hell of a hurry. I was just around the courthouse, says he, looking for you. I hope I'm not. No, says Martin, we're ready.
Court helps me, aye, and your pockets hanging down with gold and silver. Mean bloody scut. Stand as a drink itself. Divil a sweet fare. There's a Jew for you, all for number one. Cute as a shithouse rat, 105. Don't tell anyone, says the citizen.
Beg your pardon, says he.
Come on, boys, says Martin, seeing it was looking blue. Come along now. Don't tell anyone, says the citizen, letting the ball out of him. It's a secret.
And the bloody dog woke up and let a growl. Bye-bye all, says Martin. And he got them out as quick as he could, Jack Power and Crofton, however you call them, and him in the middle of them, letting on to be all at sea. Up with them on the bloody jantin' car. Off with you, says Martin to the jarvey.
The milk-white dolphin tossed his mane, and rising in the golden poop, the helmsman spread the bellying sail upon the wind, and stood off forward with all sail set, the spinnaker to larboard. And many comely nymphs drew nigh to starboard and to larboard, and clinging to the sides of the noble bark, they linked their shining forms, as doth the cunning wheelwright, when he fashions about the heart of his wheel the equidistant rays, whereof each one is sister to another. And he binds them all with an outer ring, and giveth speed to the feet of men, whenas they ride to a hosting, or contend for the smile of ladies fair. Even so did they come and set them, those willing nymphs, the undying sisters, and they laughed, sporting, in a circle of their foam, and the bark clave the waves.
But begob, I was just lower than the heel of the point when I saw the citizen getting up to waddle to the door, puffing and blowing with the dropsy, and he cursing the curse of Cromwell on him, bell, book and candle, in Irish, spitting and spatting out of him, and Joe and little Alf round him like a leprechaun throwing a pizza for him. Let me alone, says he. And begob, he got as far as the door, and they holding him, and he bawls out of him, 3 cheers for Israel!
I sit down on the parliamentary side of your ass, for Christ's sake, and don't be making a public exhibition of yourself. Jesus, there's always some bloody clown or other kicking up a bloody murder about bloody nothing. Gob, it'd have turned the porter sour in your good, so it would.
And all the ragamuffins and sluts of the nation round the door, and Martin telling the jarvey to drive ahead, and the citizen bawling, and Alf and Joe at him to whisht, and he on his high horse about the Jews and the loafers, calling for a speech, and Jack Parr trying to get him to sit down on the car and hold his bloody jaw, and a loafer with a patch over his eye starts singing, "If the man in the moon was a Jew, Jew, Jew," and a slut shouts out of her, "Hey, mister, your fly is open, mister." And says he, "Mendelssohn was a Jew, and Karl Marx, and Mercadante, and Spinoza, and the Saviour was a Jew, and his father was a Jew. Your God, he had no father," says Martin. "That'll do now, drive ahead." "Who's God?" says the citizen. "Well, his uncle was a Jew," says he. "Your God was a Jew. Christ was a Jew, like me."
God, the citizen made the plunge back into the shop. Be Jesus, says he, I'll brain that bloody Jew man for using the holy name. By Jesus, I'll crucify him, so I will. Give us that biscuit box here. Stop, stop, says Joe.
A large and appreciative gathering of friends and acquaintances from the metropolis and greater Dublin assembled in their thousands to bid farewell to Nojosogosh Uram Lipity Virag, late of Messrs. Alexander Toms, printers to His Majesty, on the occasion of his departure for the distant clime of Shashaminch Broju Guiash Dugalash, Meadow of Murmuring Waters.
The ceremony, which went off with great éclat, was characterized by the most affecting cordiality. An illuminated scroll of ancient Irish vellum, the work of Irish artists, was presented to the distinguished phenomenologist on behalf of a large section of the community, and was accompanied by the gift of a silver casket tastefully executed in the style of ancient Celtic ornament, a work which reflects every credit on the makers, Messrs. Jacob August Jacob. The departing guest was the recipient of a hearty ovation, many of those who were present being visibly moved when the select orchestra of Irish pipes struck up the well-known strains of Come Back to Erin, followed immediately by Rakoschki's March. Tar barrels and bonfires were lighted along the coastline of the four seas on the summits of the Hill of Howth, Three Rock Mountain, Sugarloaf, Brayhead, the Mountains of Mourne, the Galtees, the Ox and Donegal and Sperrin Peaks, the Nagels and the Buggeries, the Connemara Hills, the Reeks of McGillicuddy, Slieve Ochty, Slieve Burna, and Slieve Bloom. Amid cheers that rent the welkin, responded to by answering cheers from a big muster of henchmen on the distant Cambrian and Caledonian hills. The mastodontic pleasure ship slowly moved away, saluted by a final floral tribute from the representatives of the fair sex who were present in large numbers, while, as it proceeded down the river, escorted by a flotilla of barges, the flags of the ballast office and custom house were dipped in salute, as were also those of the electrical power station at the pigeon house.
Vishon Latashra Kedvesh Boraton, Vishon Latashra.
Gone, but not forgotten. Gob, the devil wouldn't stop him till he got hold of the bloody tin anyhow, and out with him, and little Alf hanging onto his elbow, and he's shouting like a stuck pig, as good as any bloody play in the Queen's Royal Theatre. Where is he till I murder him? And Ned and J.G. paralysed with the laughing. Bloody wars, says I, I'll be in for the last gospel. But as luck would have it, the Jarvie got the nag's head round the other way and off with him. Hold on, citizens, says Joe. Stop! Be gob, he drew his hand and made a swipe and let fly. Mercy o' God, the sun was in his eyes, or he'd have left him for dead. Gob, he near sent it into the county Longford. The bloody nag took fright, and the old mongrel after the car like bloody hell, and all the populace shouting and laughing, and the old tin box clattering along the street.
The catastrophe was terrific and instantaneous in its effect. The observatory of Dunsink registered in all 11 shocks, all of the fifth grade of Mercalli's scale, and there is no record extant of a similar seismic disturbance in our island since the earthquake of 1534, the year of the rebellion of Sultan Thomas. The epicentre appears to have been that part of the metropolis which constitutes the Inns Key ward and parish of St. Michan, covering the surface of 41 acres, two roods and one square pole or perch. All the lordly residences in the vicinity of the Palace of Justice were demolished, and that noble edifice itself, in which at the time of the catastrophe important legal debates were in progress, is literally a mass of ruins, beneath which, it is to be feared, all the occupants have been buried alive. From the reports of eyewitnesses, it transpires that the seismic waves were accompanied by a violent atmospheric perturbation of cyclonic character. An article of headgear, since ascertained to belong to the much-respected Clerk of the Crown and Peace, Mr. George Fottrell, and a silk umbrella with gold handle, with the engraved initials, coat of arms and house number of the erudite and worshipful chairman of Quarter Sessions, Sir Frederick Falkender,